come up on the tight wire.
Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire, when my guest today is poet Leanne Rorimpaugh. And her new book, Dandarians, came out, and it's a fantastic book. It's a book of poems, but kind of a different kind of book of poems. Stick around and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And she's also going to read the poem of the week. And one of the things I love about her new book, Dandarians, and I'm not going to tell you yet what that means. You're going to have to listen to the interview. It's really fantastic. One of the things I love about this book is how it just kind of makes you think of different words. And the other day I was in Guadalupe, Colorado. I was doing a reading, and my host was driving me around town, and there were these bunch of bikers, not, you know, motorcycle bikers, but, you know, healthy people, those sickly healthy people that are always like riding their bikes up and down mountains. And it was a whole bunch of them. She goes, oh, look, there's a peloton of bikers. I said, well, what is a peloton? She said, well, that's how you refer to a bunch of bikers, like, you know, a flock of seagulls or a school of fish. And it got me to thinking of collective nouns. That's what they're called, a collective noun. And really, there's some really fascinating ones. One of the ones I've always liked is a murder of crows. Have you ever heard of that? That's wonderful. Because, you know, crows are kind of, you know, like dark spirity. So a murder of crows makes a lot of sense. A shrewdness of apes. That's the collective noun for apes, a shrewdness of apes. It makes a lot of sense if you think about it, because apes, you know, if you're thinking about animals who are intelligent, you know, apes certainly are shrewd when it comes to, you know, compared to other animals. A glaring of cats, a glaring of cats. That kind of makes sense too, doesn't it? Because cats, you know, when you walk by them, they just look at you and make you nervous. They glare at you. An army of caterpillars, they kind of look like tanks, right? They got that shield. How about this? This makes complete sense. A cloud of gnats. That's the collective word for gnats. Did you know that? A cloud of gnats. And obviously it makes sense. But there's, you know, a peloton of bicyclists means that there are these collective nouns for people too. And I looked some up and I'm going to share some with you. Did you know that when you get a bunch of boys together, you know what they are? Probably drunk and rowdy. But other than that, they're a blush of boys. A blush of boys. That one doesn't make much sense to me. Or how about a hastiness of cooks? You get a couple of cooks in the room, you have a hastiness of cooks. Maybe it kind of makes sense, although haste is undue speed. So, you know, if your cook is in haste, it's probably not going to be very good. This one's kind of offensive, I think, personally. You know what a whole bunch of nuns are? You know, like Catholic nuns, they're walking around. When they walk around together, you know what they are? A superfluity of nuns. Is that offensive or what? A superfluity of nuns? They have no value. They're superfluous. Prisoners. You have a whole bunch of prisoners. You have a pity of prisoners. That makes sense, right? Because they're pitiful. You know, like you can pity them because they're locked behind bars. You know how, like, if you live on the border and you cross the bridge to go into Juarez, you see a bunch of these vendors of like Virgencitas. They have virgins and paintings of virgins or statues of virgins. What happens when you get a whole bunch of virgins together? Is there a collective noun for that? How about a virus of virgins? No? Okay, yeah, that sounds kind of offensive. How about a veil of virgins? You know, like a veil? That would make good. A veil of virgins? How about when you go to a Catholic store and you walk in and there's Jesus Christ's all over the place? How do you refer to collectively a bunch of Jesuses? Well, we get to make this up because we get to create language. How about a judge of Jesus's? Huh? Well, Jesus didn't really judge, so how about a bubble of Jesus's? Oh, and poets. Poets. What happens when you get Donna Snyder together and Leanne Rorimpaugh and C.D. Wright and Benjamin Alida Sainz? You get all these poets together. What would you call them? A stanza of poets. How's that? Or better yet, a clamor of poets. Writers in general, get them all together. How about a cancer of writers? Huh? Hey, I'm just making this stuff up. Norma Martinez, our producer, is probably, you know, one of the best producers in the world. And I'm sure not all producers are great. But what happens if you get a whole bunch of producers together? How about an intervention of producers? Yeah, let's make it up. And let's submit these words to the Academy of English, if there is such a thing. And we can you know, create new language, new collective nouns. I'm Daniel Chacon. Stick around and we'll talk to Leanne Rorimpaugh. Leanne Roropa is a Wyoming native and second-generation Japanese-American. She studied music, earning a BM in piano performance and an MM in musical history before getting her MFA in creative writing from Indiana University. She is author of 4 collections of poems, including her very latest book, Dandarians, which we're going to talk about today. Leanne, welcome to Words on a Wire.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for talking to me today.
Well, congratulations on this book. And I have to say, this is a weird book, and in a good way. It's not what you expect when you pick up a book of poems. And even the title itself has an amazing background. If you can tell us a little bit about the title, Dandarians.
Sure. The title comes from what I think of as a series of word betrayals. I'm second-generation Japanese-American, and my mother was a first-generation immigrant to the country, and that meant that she was a non-native speaker. And so growing up in my house, language could be unstable or liminal or hybrid in sometimes unsettling ways. And so Dandarians comes from the way that I understood the word dandelions from my Japanese mother. And to me, Dandarians sounded very futuristic. It sounded sci-fi, or it sounded like an alien planet. So it was one of the ways, too, I was thinking of issues of diaspora and what it means to be immigrant or culturally alien in one way or another. And so that became the title of the book, as a way of thinking through some of those issues of language and Asian diaspora in tandem with that notion of feeling kind of like science fiction-y as a result. And so that was the first word betrayal in the book. And so there's a series of kind of linked poetic / essays, I guess I would call them, that kind of explore these series of word betrayals then.
I like that. Is that a term that we can say you coined, word betrayals? Because it makes sense.
Yeah, because I was trying to think about what I was doing with this book or what I wanted to do with the book. And that kind of slipperiness of signifier and signified, which is something that, you know, if you grow up within a language and you see it as being transparent, and, you know, usually you become a writer or a poet to kind of then start to question, you know, aspects, I think, of materiality of language, or you start to think about linguistics and language maybe, you know, in school. But I think sometimes if you come from a different ethnic subject position, you know, the language is already not stable or transparent in those ways. And so, you know, it can be sort of a betrayal of sorts, or you have to question it, or its use is not as easy as it might be if you come from a different subject position.
Yeah, and what's really wonderful about that word, Dandarians, is it not only does it make a commentary on, you know, on the different ways that we speak words, but also the imagination of a child hearing a sound and that sound, you know, becoming much more than, you know, what it's intended. And I'm not sure if when the child, the speaker of the poem, I'm not going to assume that it's you, the speaker of the poem hears this word, does the speaker of the poem at first know that it's supposed to be a dandelion? Or the speaker found out in school, I think, right?
Yeah, so the speaker finds this out in school, and so in her mind, you know, they're pronounced Dandarians, and they start to take on all of these, you know, connotative associations for her, the way that language does sort of function in these rich and imaginative ways. So I guess the flip side of the betrayal is that these words are sort of emotionally and associatively resonant for her. And these lyric flash essays are in fact very, very personal essays for me.
When I was a kid, I used to love grilled cheese sandwiches, but I was always embarrassed to eat them because I thought they were called girl cheese sandwiches. And I thought,
yeah,
well, I'm a boy. Should I really be eating these?
Well, for a long time, I thought that my mother would call nachos matchas. So I thought that was because they were very spicy or had jalapenos on them, and so you had to be macho to eat them.
Oh, I love it. Yes. So that's a word betrayal, too, in a sense. The word betrayal does not necessarily have to be based on pronunciation of a particular person, but just the word itself. Like, for example, you hear the word disaster, and you think of a name. You picture somebody named D'Aster.
Mm-hmm.
And that's wonderful, because I think we all do that. We all experience these word betrayals, but you're putting it into a whole book, and you're introducing us to different ways that we hear sounds. And
yes, because things can be onomatopoeic or associative in really interesting ways. And so everyone can have a word betrayal because, language is actually very slippery.
Right. You know, when I was a young Chicano in high school, I was in theater, and my teacher was talking about Aristophanes' Lysistrata, and I thought it was Liz Estrada.
Oh, yes, that's lovely.
And then I actually ended up writing a play, based a Chicano version, because it's a story about, the men are at war and the women say, let's not have sex with them and maybe they'll stop the war. And I kind of did an adaptation where there were two rival Chicano gangs and the women got together to.
That's fabulous.
So the point is, I guess, word betrayals can really lead to imaginative landscapes and can take you almost anywhere.
Absolutely.
And the places this book goes, it's just amazing. Tell us about Oheso. I love this image in your book. You hear the word Oheso. Well, I'll let you tell it.
Well, Oheso is a Japanese word for navel or belly button. It's one of those things where I'm only in school and I realize that, other children have belly buttons and I have an oheso. And so, that's sort of unnerving. It's that kind of slipperiness that then raises sort of unsettling questions about identity. So like, if I have an oheso, it's just because I'm different, because, I'm half Japanese. Everyone else has a belly button. I have an oheso. Does that mean my parts are different? And then it sounds to me like, FISO hex. And so I'm wondering if it has something to do with the soap, And so it raises all these unsettling questions then about sort of bodily integrity, I think, in that particular piece.
I read in your bio that you have a master's degree in musicology and your bachelor's is in music and piano performance.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm wondering how much of that music makes its way into how you think of words.
I think it has a lot to do with how I think of words, because I love the way that words feel in my mouth when I say them, or the way that they sound out loud as I'm reading. For me, the musicality of the poem is very important. Things feel like phrases, or there's, accelerations, or there's crescendos and decrescendos. And so I think I feel something out as if I were playing music, as I'm tapping into the musicality of a particular poem.
I'm talking to Leanne Worapa, whose new book is called Dandarians. It's a book of poems, but if I were to try to describe what kind of poems these are to somebody who hasn't seen the book, I wouldn't say they're prose poems, even though they're, they look on the page as if they're prose. But would it be fair to say they're kind of influenced by Japanese poetic forms, perhaps a haibun, which is, a combination of prose and haiku?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the poems, Inkuline, is definitely written as a haibun, but the form, the poetic prose form of haibun, is definitely a significant formal influence for me in this book. Ishitsu as well, the running brush prose style, I think was an influence I had in the back of my mind for these pieces too.
Yeah, and in many ways, this book has a lot to do with growing up Japanese and identifying, oneself as Japanese. And I understand there's some influence from the, I don't know if I'm going to say it right, so please correct me, the Heian period of female writers, Japan female writers. And I didn't know what this was, and I looked it up. And it's really fascinating that, you know, in between 794 and 1185, I'm talking about the years, there were some incredibly important female writers in Japan. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. It was just this really rich period for literature, and literature was very revered and practiced. I mean, people celebrated with literature. So, for example, if there was a special kind of moon, then people might organize a moon viewing event, and then people might write poems and have contests with the writing of the poems. People courted through poetry. So, you know, if you wanted to, you know, impress someone, you had to write like a lovely poem, and you had to have nice calligraphy and the right kind of paper and scent it with, you know, a nice incense and tie it up tastefully. I mean, so the poetry and literature were an important kind of currency. And amazingly, a lot of the significant practitioners were women. And so, for example, Lady Murasaki wrote The Tale of Genji during this time period, as well as important journals. The Tale of Genji is really the first extant novel that we're aware of in literature.
Wow.
Say Shanagan wrote the Pillow Book, which is a collection of sort of journals and list poems and prose writings. There were a number of women poets who were working, Onono Huachi, and a lot of diarists. Some of them are anonymous at this point, but there was a flourishing of literature, and a lot of it holds up really well today, even despite the passage of so much time and, you know, some of the vagaries of translation. And so I love these writers. And as we think about, you know, how we kind of situate ourselves, you know, what sort of traditions we might wish to align ourselves with, or what kind of speaks to us in terms of our literary roots, you know, I wanted to, you know, resituate myself from, say, you know, a traditional European canon, and, you know, thinking about who is my tradition, or where might I come from, and that was perhaps, you know, a literary tradition that spoke to me in resonant ways.
Well, that's fascinating, and I think we can choose our antepasados, we can choose our ancestors, and the fact that you are identifying with this incredible movement in literature where the women were writing just as much as men, and their works were just as important as men. And I'm thinking of, you know, that kind of gender balance culture, you know, must have really allowed for some very, very interesting and deep poetry. I wish people would look this up and start reading these poets, because it just sounds fascinating.
It's really interesting, yeah.
In the pre-Heian era, the sun was related to a female goddess, as opposed to most Western cultures where the sun is the male and the moon is the female. And I find that really interesting.
I think important, too, you know, as women writers in particular, who are, you know, in that struggle to kind of figure out how to align ourselves, what sort of traditions we might be able to belong to frequently, since we feel marginalized, and to even like sometimes feeling marginalized, you know, for other reasons, you know, ethnicity or orientation. And so, you know, finding that place, I don't know, those lineages that we feel mirror us, include us.
We're talking to Leanne Rorimpaw, author of Dandarians, a book that just came out, a book of poems. What I love about this book, it challenges me with new words. There are so many words that, you know, I had to look up or wanted to look up, because you don't have to look up the words, because the music of the language will just take you right through. But I love new words, like, you know, most of us do. I guess that's why we get into writing. But I found this image, and I think it's very beautiful. And this, to me, captures a lot of what's going on in this book. It's from the poem called Daylight Savings Time and Interrogatory.
Interrogatory.
Interrogatory. There's this line. I want to read it aloud. It says, "The awkward entreaties of swept away tree branches semaphoring for help." I love that word, semaphoring. And I got the image immediately of the trees semaphoring. And the only reason is because in Spanish, you know, we don't have stoplights. We have semáforas.
Oh,
semáforos.
Yeah.
And obviously there's a connection between those two, but it's a wonderful word. It's a wonderful word. And I had never heard of it before. And this book is really introducing me to a lot of new words. And I have to ask, where do you get all these words? I know it's a silly question, but do you like thumb through the dictionary for fun, or is it just you hear these words and you follow them?
I hear the words and I follow them. I usually love the way that they sound. For a long time, I used to have a crush list of words, you know, words
no way.
That I had a crush on and that I hoped I might find the right place to use. I want to be careful not to use them gratuitously, right? But if it's the right fit and the right sound, like a word that I really love, then I know that I'll put it away for usage at some point in time.
Wow. See, you really are in love with words, because if there's such thing as a word betrayal and a crush list of words, that pretty much encompasses the relationship of romantic love.
Yeah, absolutely.
The crush
absolutely.
And then the betrayal.
Right?
There's this poem called Anemone.
Yes.
Anemone. Yeah. And I didn't know what anemone was. And I Googled it, and you know what came up?
What came up?
News about Leanne Rohrpaugh.
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
That's fabulous.
Anemone, which is, I believe, some sort of plant.
Right. I was, it was sort of a mispronunciation for, like, you know, sea anemones, you know, and my mother pronounced it anemone, which, you know, then kind of it sounded like alimony, for example, or and it contained the word moan in it, which was sort of sad or
beautiful
making.
Yeah. And then here's a line when your mother said that word. When she says the name of any flower, she says it like something perfect and beautiful in the mouth.
Yeah.
And that's what you were talking about earlier, how, you know, just the sound of some things, it just want to say it.
Yes, absolutely.
I love the word superfluous.
Yeah.
Oh, it betrayed me, because I used to think it was superfluous.
Right? Yeah.
And then one time, you know, the word forte, spelled F-O-R-T-E, but I didn't know, and I thought it was pronounced fort. And I remember I was talking to this... I was like an adult already. I think I was in my 30s, and I was talking to the Shakespearean scholar, you know, who knew me as a playwright, but I quit writing plays. And I says, yeah, I just realized it's not my fort. And she kind of stares at me blankly. And finally she goes, you mean forte?
Of course. I mean, I used to love the word susurrus, but I loved it because I thought it was pronounced susurrus, which sounded beautiful and kind of onomatopoeic. But then when I found out it was really pronounced susurrus, I didn't like it as much. So.
You know, not only does it take us to, you know, incredibly, really philosophical, intellectual levels, and not only does it, you know, give us a lot of music, but there's an innocence about it too. That this child, you know, relating to words and relating to language. And there's this one image in that poem, Anemone, that I just love, and it's describing a swimming teacher. He says, our swim teacher's name is Daryl. He sports a blonde afro. I mean, just that in itself is a wonderful image. He wears a Speedo. He counts out loud, supervises our bobs on the side of the pool, line of rubber caps fronted by squinched faces burbling up and down like bright lottery balls. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
And it really is innocent. You know, there's a lot of innocence in here. There's a lot of vulnerability. Was it a difficult book to write?
It was a really, really difficult book to write. I don't know. I agonized over it, and in particular, the word betrayal pieces were the hardest to write.
Well, I'm talking to Leanne Rohrpaugh, whose book Dandarians just came out. It's a book of poems, and this is your fourth book.
And That's correct.
This is the first time you really haven't used line breaks. Was it difficult to get away from wanting to just put a, you know, put a line there, put an enjambment or something? I mean, was that a difficult thing for you to do? Because I've read some of your other poems, and your lines are just beautiful. It must have been a challenge to not use lines.
It was. It was a different kind of challenge, because I usually do. I usually am very attentive to the line, and I like thinking a lot about what one can do with a line break. So it created a different kind of challenge in terms of figuring out how to create music within the wraparound prose lines, without having access to the line breaks. It was also liberating, too. I think it gave me permission to do certain kinds of things rhythmically and syntactically that I maybe hadn't been doing when I was focused on breaking the line.
Wow.
So it was a challenge, but it was liberating in different ways, too.
Yeah, I can understand that. I've been a fiction writer. You know, all my books are in fiction, but I'm working on a book of poems now, and there is something liberating about it and challenging about it. And so I don't know if you're ever going to write fiction, but I would read your fiction if you do.
Thank you. I do write fiction. I do write short stories. So
You don't have a book out yet?
I don't have a book out. I have appearances in literary journals. I would love to put together a collection of stories.
Well, we'll get you on the show when that comes out, because I'm sure it'll be fantastic when you can characterize a swim teacher with a blonde afro in two lines.
Thank you.
Well, we're running out of time, but if you would read one of your poems to us, that would be awesome.
Okay. Why don't I read the final piece in the book, since we're talking about music. This is called The Violin Thief. The violin thief slips away into the bird-stunned blaze of morning, sticky fingers steeped in pine, sun, an ambered cake of rosin sliding up the sky by unseen hydraulics. Perhaps the violin shouldn't let itself be played in the hands of a thief, but the violin thief understands the laws of harmonics that invisibly subdivide the glistening neck, the unmapped and inscrutable intonation of silky ebony fingerboard yielding to calloused fingertips, how to balance the unwieldy contrariness of the bow with only the lightest of grips. So in the end, the stolen music exists solely for the violin thief, making the violin thief an owner of sorts of the once silent violin that now sings willingly in larceny. Music everywhere. Do you hear the confidential pizzicato of rain pinging the window pane? The train whistle fiddling double stops? Whisper of horsehair against rosin, a song of brushed hair? The staccato of the coffee maker's sputter? Woodpeckers trilling a delicate collegno. The violin thief isn't boy or girl, man or woman, ghost or hallucination. The violin thief is the parched thirst of night's velvety inked blackness, the stained mouthings of dipsomaniacal iris drinking night's bruised wine until drought-ridden stars drop from the emptied goblet of sky. The relentless bee that greedily searches for stars in the purple mouths of the iris, stealing away with a bright crest of pollen on its legs like golden crumbs of rosin dust.
That was Leanne Rorimpa reading The Violin Thief from her new book, Dandarians. And I have to say that poem was very dipsomaniacal.
Dipsomaniacal is a kind of drunkenness.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That is my word then. That is definitely my word. Thank you so much for joining us, Leanne, and I wish you the best on this book. Good luck on this.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you for joining me for this edition of Words on a Wire, and thank you, Leanne Rorimpa, for that wonderful discussion, and it's a fantastic book, Dandarians, and now that you know what the title is, isn't it great? Is that a fantastic title? I'd like to invite you to join us every week on Words on a Wire when we have wonderful, brilliant poets like Leanne. I'm Daniel Chacon. Don't forget, the next book you read may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire.